Rory is a writer and licensed attorney. Previously, he ran Foglight Strategies, a campaign research services firm for forward-thinking prosecutors, and worked for the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, Harvard Law School Fair Punishment Project, and the National Network for Safe Communications at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He lives in Philadelphia, and now he's here with us. Everybody give Rory Fleming a big round of applause. All right, Rory, welcome.
Thank you, Mike. That was a wonderful introduction, and I'm really happy to be here. And thank you for sharing your stories. They're so hard, and I'm so sorry for all the things that everybody here has been dealing with. But I'm really happy to share some potentially good news. As Mike was saying, I've written this article, Is the Tide Turning Against Public Sex Offender Registries, for Filter Magazine. And the article, you know, I will be humble and say it's you know, just an article, but it talks about something that's a big deal, which is the American Law Institute coming out against public registries, as well as proposing a lot of other changes, which would be 15 years being the maximum registration length. I still probably too long in a lot of cases, but what they do say is 10 for good behavior, and then you can essentially petition the court earlier than that to argue rehabilitation and things of that nature. They recommend strong court presumptions against pretty much every other collateral consequence. So residency restrictions and computer restrictions and things of that nature. They say that, you know, in very difficult circumstances, maybe those collateral consequences may make sense, but the presumption in law would be to be for them to be used very sparingly and for a very limited duration. And of course, you know, the law enforcement access only is I think probably the most important thing besides, well, there's that, and then there's the fact that they said their recommendation would be to limit it to five contact offenses. It was essentially three different kinds of rape charge, but two of them you would have to have a prior felony sex offense. So essentially, the only one of those involving adult victims would be essentially the statute would be rape at gunpoint kind of thing, like armed rape. And then the other two are a person over 21 having sex with somebody, somebody under 12, which is quite a serious offense, obviously. And then the other one would be a penetrative offense with somebody under 16 if you're the parent or guardian. So, and even with those, the registry would be private to law enforcement access only. There'd be no public notification, things of that nature. So we're talking about essentially going probably from a million to, I don't have a full list of, you know, all the offenses on the registry, but I would probably estimate 50,000 people or less nationwide. And then those people who are on it would be a law enforcement access only registry, which of course the ALI brings up that's how it works in every other developed nation. Well, actually pretty much every nation on earth, right? So a couple of third world countries have rudimentary registries, but they're predominantly a developed Western democracy kind of phenomenon that was imported from the US because we were the first one to do it. And out of all of the countries in Europe, Canada, Australia, etc., I think there's maybe one or two provinces in Canada that have some level of public registry, and then one in Australia, I think, and Poland maybe has a very limited public registry as well. And then every other country doesn't. They just don't. And they of course bring this up because they're hey, from the US perspective, that sounds really radical. But it's actually not radical. In fact, it's what every other nation is doing, and we don't have a public safety benefit to show for it, essentially. But we do have all of the types of stories that have been shared tonight, the collateral damage, as well as the refusing a life of dignity and rehabilitation that's actually recognized by society for people who are on the registry. So I should also say, I should have probably said this before I went on to all that stuff, but yeah, American Law Institute, you know, that's the kind of thing that has a generic enough name where it could be just some guy in his basement makes the American Law Institute. It says it's a big deal, or it could be actually a big deal. And we're talking about like an actual big deal here. So so I'll give you an example. There are about 850 federal judges in America. And ALI members, there's about 300 of the 800 or so that are members of American Law Institute. It's also like every dean at every American law school is a part of ALI. It's like elected membership, and then certain people at certain positions are given kind of a de facto membership. But otherwise it's invite only. But people who are given like automatic membership are like deans of law schools in the Supreme Court. But everyone else is elected, and it's like hundreds of federal judges, law judges of various levels at the state level. So like appellate judges, like Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, some trial court judges, and tons of law professors. It's a very, very elite organization. A professor named Ira Ellman, who is instrumental in putting together the proposal, has brought up that American Law Institute was the first major group to propose banning criminal laws against quote-unquote sodomy. So obviously there were some states that still criminalized homosexual sex between adults up until 2003 with Lawrence v. Texas, which is a Supreme Court decision. But ALI back in 1962 recommended that those statutes be stricken. And that's when a lot of states started to look at striking those laws. So a lot of states outside of the Deep South got rid of their sodomy laws in the 60s and 70s. Of course, it didn't spread to everywhere until the Supreme Court weighed in, but it was a pretty major step forward. And it's quite possible that, you know, if ALI wasn't the first domino, what would have done it, basically? And so it's a pretty big deal. I think that, and essentially where this is kind of at is they started the project looking at the sex registry as well as recodification of their model criminal law for different like sex offense statutes in 2012. So this has been a long time going, but this year in June, on June 8th, the 3,000 members of ALI, the elected members, got together over Zoom because of the pandemic, of course, and they voted to approve of this draft, right? And so the draft is the full draft. If one wants to read it, you can download it from ALI's website for free. They need to go through a revision process to publish the final copy in print. That'll probably take another year or two, but basically membership has approved this draft, tentative draft 5. Now it goes back to the ALI council to do like final revisions, but substantively the material will remain the same. And then they will go through the publication process. But the fact that membership has voted on it means that it's a go. And it's a pretty big deal. I think that they have not been, as you might surmise, super public about it. It's not like they're putting on a billboard and screaming it from the rooftops, but they also would not. I mean, obviously, this is going to be a really solid schematic for advocating for legislative change. People talk about how, like, different ALI materials are taught in law schools. Like pretty much every judge in the country like owns the ALI like book set. Like this is and also like ACLU of Michigan in 2019 was using a slightly different draft that had a lot of the same stuff in it for advocating to the legislature in Michigan. This is going to be something that's going to be continued to, like, this is going to be a thing that is talked about, you know, for many years to come. I think that, I should note that the draft, you can read the executive summary and stuff like that, but the draft is 600 pages long. It's very long. The registry portion is a little shorter because it's like the ALI, it's like model penal code for like sex offenses. They did some revisions and that's like 400 pages. And then the registry part is like 150, 200 pages or something. So it is quite long because they explain with like citations to different academic sources and research studies and, you know, government studies, why they are recommending these things. So it's not like they're just like, oh, we're a bunch of famous people from on high saying this is what the law should be. They're looking at how different countries do things. They're looking at recidivism rates. They're looking at various academic articles from different disciplines and essentially with their wealth of expertise and knowledge and clout saying this is what it should be. So it's a really big deal. I think it's the kind of thing that I've talked to a number of friends in criminal justice reform circles and journalistic circles, and they're like, you know, maybe this seems like a little bit inside baseball, and I'm like, well, sure, but like it's going to be one of those things where that like this 20, 30 years from now, historians might look at this as like, this is kind of the root in terms of like mainstream academic and legal circles starting to take note about this issue. Basically that's what this article I wrote is about. And it was exciting for me to see because of the fact that this is an issue that I care about. And I've worked in various criminal justice reform organizations for the last 6 years since graduating from law school. And of course, the sex offender registry topics are something that a lot of the mainstream nonprofits and stuff don't want to touch. They don't want to talk about it. And from a political optics standpoint, I understand why, I guess. I would talk to different nonprofit leaders behind closed doors, and kind of like what we've heard from a number of people when it comes to like talking to people you might meet, they would often tell me like, hey, yeah, like I support getting rid of at the very least the public registry, but like I don't want to say it out loud. I had the chief prosecutor of Seattle, of King County, Washington, say the same thing to me when I was asking him about different policy issues when I almost worked for his reelection campaign. Yeah. And I remember telling a friend of mine at the time, like, I don't generally believe in this kind of thing, but I wish I had a tape recorder, right? But of course, just to show, like, hey, like, this is an elected prosecutor saying this. And I think that generally speaking, that kind of phenomenon isn't that unheard of within law enforcement. But I think of one of the stories I heard tonight about the, you know, you have the elected prosecutor in pretty much every state at the local level, and they, you know, feel a great pressure to respond to the loudest constituents on issues. And so the path of least resistance is often to say, charge the person on the registry with a bogus offense, even though they did nothing wrong, and have the judge sort it out later. So I think that while there is some exciting stuff happening in with prosecutorial change, I think that it's really helpful for an organization like American Law Institute to kind of take the first crack at the apple from the academic and legal standpoint, because, you know, federal judges are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And, you know, they're not going to get their house egged or something for saying this kind of stuff. Like, they can say whatever they want. But of course, I think it's very beneficial that these folks are saying what they want, and it's get rid of the registry. I mean, when you read the document, the draft talks about how essentially even having the very limited private registry that they suggest was a compromise of sorts to recognize that unfortunately, the registry in some capacity has become like a modern expectation of American life. So their thought process was essentially that if they recommended get rid of it entirely, then legislators would just shut their ears, basically. Like, we can't listen to this, right? But they consulted with a lot of directly impacted people, as well as defense lawyers and, you know, civil rights lawyers and things like that. And they felt like this was essentially the way to go about essentially arguing as close as they could to abolition of the registry without, like, straight up saying it. But obviously, from the perspective of, like, we shouldn't have them at all, like, it's going to leave a little bit to be desired, but from a mainstream source like this, it's still, I mean, I know that as somebody who's been interested in these issues for a long time, I was reading it, I was very, very surprised, frankly, to see it. I mean, especially because it's like a lot of the same federal judges who are sending people to federal prison for a decade for looking at pictures online. I mean, it's not like all the same people, but it's like some of the same people. And I think that, of course, that's a little disheartening because it's like, why can't they think of that more when they're actually doing their day job? That I find irritating. But of course, on the federal level, at least, you have like the very, they're not mandatory, but they're close to mandatory, the sentencing guidelines. And they're very problematic and broken, and partly from congressional mandate. I think that probably like covers like the broad kind of scope of what the project is from ALI and why it matters. I think that I would definitely recommend anyone personally like interested in doing like legislative advocacy to check it out. Maybe at least like the executive summary, which is about 30 pages long, because I think that it lays out quite a compelling, you know, argument from like a source that is emotionally not directly invested, right? Because these folks are people who, you know, like maybe they know somebody on the registry, but like on a personal level, but I mean, they very well could not.
Everyone does.
I think
that's someone on the registry at maybe not a personal level, but a friend of a friend.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Everyone, yeah. It sounds like to me that this is the big domino that must fall first.
Right.
For eliminating the registry completely, this is the big domino that has to fall first. Would you agree? Mm-hmm.
I think that's definitely true. So I think that in a lot of ways, the heart of what we talk about when we talk about the registry is the public component of it. Because if it was just a private, essentially almost like a private criminal records database, but maybe with a little bit more information, okay, like the difference would be, say a police officer wants to ALI talks about in the sense of like, you know, what if there is like a polyclass type of situation, there's like a high profile, like sex motivated kidnapping, or at least that's like the suspicion of like a young child. They can, you know, compare the profile essentially with like, you know, people on the private registry who've committed like actually similar offenses to that, as like an investigative starting point. And of course, there's some problems with that, obviously. But basically, like the main difference between them just looking on a criminal history database and the private law enforcement registry would be things like address. You know, they could just like check in and see if that person's home, right? Still, probably not ideal, but like we can understand why from a law enforcement perspective that seems potentially helpful. But the thing is that essentially like somebody can't go on the internet, right, and like look it up, You know, somebody can't even, like in the UK, what people can do, and people don't really often, but, and they have, and it's because they have to have an official purpose. But say if somebody volunteers with children or, you know, works as an educator of young children or something, they can call up it, like with like a suspicious persons type of report to the local police department and ask if that person's on the registry. They're not allowed to tell anyone else. But like the police officer can say yes or no. That's not even like what ALI is recommending. Like it's very limited, and unauthorized distribution of registry information, which of course like includes like name, but also stuff like address, is actually a felony, which carries about, I think it's like a maximum of 5 years. This is the recommendation from ALI. So like they're serious about it. They're serious to the point of like, you know, there's all those people who do stuff like homefacts.com or whatever and have their own like little private registries that they assemble from like state information. Like that would be a felony crime. That's not a risk worth taking for almost any, I mean, any sane person essentially is not going to be like, I want to be a vigilante so bad on the internet that I'm going to take a felony conviction in prison time for it. I keep saying ALI. It's the American Law Institute. And this project that I'm talking about is the Model Penal Code Revision on Sexual Assault and Related Offenses is what it's called. And they have like 100, 150 pages of registry-specific recommendations on there as well.
You could send me a link to that
so yes.
that I can share it with our followers?
Definitely. So I believe, okay, so what I'll send is, there's this, so you have to become a member of you have to sign up for this free email thing, but they did post the executive summary, which I will bring up. It's on Mitchell Hamlin. Just 1 second. I'm sorry. I should have had this up. Yeah, I it's silly to me that like it's not just completely public, but I guess it's a membership organization and stuff like that. Oh, okay. So here's Ira Ellman's blog post, and at the end of this, there's the executive summary, which is about 30 pages, and that is. Here. So that should be helpful. If you want the full 600-page PDF, I can send it to you. I do have it. I have it in my email, and I've saved it. I've read a good bit of it, but it's obviously long. Even just like the registry-specific part of it is 100, 150 pages. It's like a book, right? And it's pretty dense and legalistic, but definitely
a legal scholar to even understand it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not quite that bad, but it's definitely somewhat dense. I will say that. And like, luckily, you know, with all this stuff, because of the fact that what they're doing here, because this is a part of the Model Penal Code project that they've been doing since the 60s, this is they have like what they call the black letter law section, which is their recommendation of what the actual law would read. And so that's something that's historically helpful because legislators, a lot of them are lazy and they're like, I don't want to write my own bill. And so then they copy paste stuff from American Law Institute. There's a lot of examples of legislators just ripping stuff straight out of ALI books and putting them into law. So definitely the executive summary is worth reading. And I think that summary also does have the quote unquote black letter law as well. If it doesn't, it's at the end. Yeah, they do. They actually do. I mean, like, granted, reading that isn't going to be very interesting if you're not a lawyer because it's just like legalese, right? But they explain like why the different phrases are in there and like what they mean under law, like or what they would mean under the law if a state was to enact that provision. And so, yeah, I think that's pretty cool.
Well, I think that your title just of your article really sums it up. Mm-hmm. Is the tide turning?
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I just hit that right on the nail. And I've always thought that it's just so difficult for the public to mm-hmm. lean toward eliminating the registry completely, that there had to be a domino that has to fall first, that's right. more palatable mm-hmm. before just eliminating the registry completely.
I think that's true. And I think that the thing too, what they will find, and actually bear with me for a second. I'm going to stop my video because I'm going to be walking down the stairs of my house. And you know, my wife wants to go to bed. I'm in the bedroom right now. She was on her own Zoom call. And so we're doing a little switcheroo real quick, but I'll keep talking. So yes, I think that what's going to happen if this is to happen is what they'll learn is that the public registry isn't actually, or sorry, the private registry isn't actually that helpful because the registry itself is not helpful from any kind of legitimate public safety angle. I think that what you'll find is very similar, or what they would find, what law enforcement would find. Just one second.
Oh yeah, hi. So I'm back. It's my wife with the hair, but yeah, so basically when I was talking with Dan Satterberg, who's the district attorney, well, he's the prosecuting attorney of Seattle, of King County, Washington, he was like, you know, the registry is useless from a public safety standpoint. And his kind of explanation as to why is, you know, it's this tunnel vision effect where say the police are investigating a sex crime, like a kidnapping or something like that. And they have, you know, they know that, you know, maybe 100 people in the zip code or something are on the registry and they're going to assume it's one of them. Right. Even though, criminological statistics show that virtually all sex crime is committed by somebody not on the registry.
Not on the registry. Yeah.
It's a giant red herring. And of course, like, you know, Dan Satterberg, his standpoint was not at least explicitly coming from a position of empathy for people on it. It was more of a, from my job as a prosecutor, I want to make sure that we're getting the right person and not wasting law enforcement resources, giving them essentially a bias toward like certain people just by nature of what they did in the past. And so I think that that kind of thing, of course, is one of those things where it's like probably it's not going to resonate for people who are directly impacted, but it is one of those things that is going to resonate in like a legislative chamber. And of course, American Law Institute brings up those sorts of arguments as well. But of course, they essentially say they're pretty agnostic on even the private registry, but it's essentially a conciliatory measure, given that they know that this is a public expectation. And of course, like one of the things I think that is worth noting too is that, you know, they consulted with a broad body of different like advocacy groups and nonprofits, and they were talking to, you know, everybody from Patty Wetterling to, you know, people like Mark Class or something, you know, like we're like, you know, I mean, maybe not literally Mark Class, but like people like that, you know, they have some like really tough on crime, law and order, child protection, like oriented, like DAs and stuff, like prosecutors that they talked with. And like, I'm sure that like a lot of those types of folks weren't like, you know, thrilled by even the recommendation of a private registry only. I mean, like part of what my piece talks about is that, and I should have mentioned this too, but it's a little bit different than the ALI thing. You know, American Law Institute solicits comments from like interested members of the public on different projects and stuff. And they did get a letter from RAIN, like a rape, incest, abuse. I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's like an anti-rape organization of some sort, like victim advocacy thing, and National District Attorneys Association. And they were very, you know, they were mad about a lot of the different recommendations in ALI, like in this project that ALI did, and they were advocating for the members to reject the draft. Of course, what I picked out of the letter, which is short, it's like 3 pages, and I think I linked it in my filter piece, is that they actually, this is like the NDAA is the group that represents elected prosecutors across the country. And it's very conservative. It's very law and order. They actually, in their section complaining about the suggested reforms to the registry from ALI, they actually didn't even make a stink about switching from public to private registry. Instead, what they complained about was they felt like, you know, it should be more than just those 5 offenses that ALI said qualified. And they complained about the fact that they don't have the thing that like England has, where like a child care provider can't call up and ask if somebody is on the registry. But they did not, NDAA and RAIN and like, you know, these other groups that opposed this recommendation did not complain about making the registry private.
Rory, we're going to move this conversation into Mics Open.
Oh, yes. Sorry. I didn't mean to go over. Did I miss the card?
Oh, well, I forgot to tell you to pin the timer. He's always. But hold your thought. We are going to go into Mics Open here in just a second. But for now, I always want to keep my promise and tell people that we're stopping the meeting at 8:30. And then after 8:30, we have Mics Open, where we come in, we ask our guest speaker questions. It's like it is, says, it's open mic, called Mic Open. So anyway, I want to thank everyone for participating in War Room number 10. Number 10 is a number we should celebrate. I am just overwhelmed at the participation, the camaraderie, the friendship, and uniting and coming together to find our voice and what the War Room here has provided. I want to thank everybody for participating again, and I look forward to seeing you at the next meeting. Everybody give Rory Fleming a big round of applause. Thank you, Rory. You may stop recording.